Hey there, sports history fan. Arnie Chapman here from the Sports History Network. Now, before you jump into this episode, I wanted to share with you an exciting giveaway we have going on with Home Field Apparel. We have a digital $50 gift card to homefieldapparel.com for one lucky fan of the Sports History Network. All you got to do is head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways to sign up. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways.
Football historian and author Greg Fisseri, writer of the book Gridiron Legacy, Pro Football's Missing Origin Story, discusses one of the key early pro football teams before the NFL, the Homestead Library and Athletic Club. And we've got Greg's take on the team and more coming up in just a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pigpen, your portal to positive football history. And we are going back in time again to talk about one of these early 20th century pro football teams that is so interesting and so vital to what the game has become today. And we are bringing in our friend, a great historian who wrote an excellent book on that era that happens to be about his family member that played in this era and played on some great teams back then, Greg Fisseri. Greg, welcome back to the Pigpen.
Thanks, Darren. Good to be back. I'm feeling like a regular.
Yeah, we're going to have to give you a time clock here, I guess, here in the Pigpen. So, you know, Greg, you had this great book that you had come out recently at the end of last year. Maybe you could remind us of the name and where folks can get that.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. It's called Gridiron Legacy, Pro Football's Missing Origin Story. And right now it's available at the book's website, gridironlegacy.com. And later in the year, it will become available on Amazon and several of the other main online retailers as soon as we get them some inventory.
Okay. And folks, if you missed it, we had Greg has been on many radio programs, podcasts. He's been all over telling people about this great story. And we have a podcast we recorded back in November with Greg. I believe it came out on November 7th. So if you want to go back and listen to that when you're done with this podcast, feel free and you'll learn a little bit more about the book, because we're going to really centralize into an earlier portion of the story that Greg tells, an earlier portion of his great-grandfather, Bob Shiring's, inclusion in pro football and his sort of his starting point. And that would be the Homestead Library team. And Greg, if you could sort of maybe tell us, you know, what was the Homestead Library team and how did it originate and some of the parties involved?
Mm-hmm. The Homestead Library team, and technically it was called HLNAC, the Homestead Library and Athletic Club at the time. And the club itself was opened in 1898, according to its cornerstone, and it still stands in Homestead, I believe. Was it 10th Street? A couple blocks above the river. It's a spectacular building that's now called the Carnegie Library of Homestead. So it had an amateur team for a couple years, as it was getting its legs under itself, I guess. And, in the previous 6-7 years before that, pro football had started in Pittsburgh with some of the names that historians are familiar with, such as the Allegheny Athletic Association, where Pudge Heffelfinger started playing professionally in 1892, the first, pro player based on the birth certificate of pro football, that accounting ledger that is in the Hall of Fame, and the Pittsburgh Athletic Club, which was their main rival for a couple of years, Greensburg and Latrobe. Dave Barry ran that Latrobe team with John Brailleur for a few years. And for many years, people thought he was the first pro to be paid, you know, starting in 1895, but that birth certificate certificates surfaced much, much later in the 1960s. So after those teams ran with the pro ball, as it were, for the first few years, Duquesne came into the mix, DC and AC, Duquesne Country and Athletic Club. And William Chase Temple was the owner, or one of the owners, of the Pittsburgh Pirates baseball team. And he sponsored something called the Temple Cup, which was the trophy for the National League champions. And I believe it was around, I might not get my years exactly right, 1896 or so. Something happened between the two teams that won the National League, and the winner take all the money, which was supposed to happen. Somehow they agreed to split the money, and Temple wasn't happy with how it played out and sort of felt like his cup was sullied in a way. So he sold off his interest in the Pirates and decided to get into football, which was younger, and he had more control over the development of the game. And they quickly built a team that beat the other teams that had been around and won the championship in, I think, 1897-98. So, again, something happened with Temple, and he had agreed to subsidize the team for the board and the club. But somehow the board thought that the team should have made a lot of money. But Temple paid a lot for all the players that he accumulated, especially ones coming back from the Spanish-American War. And they sort of overstuffed the roster to prevent other teams from getting them. And he sort of left the team disgruntled, feeling unappreciated, maybe accused of not managing the funds right, whatever the case was. He said, I'm done with Duquesne. So 1899 came around, and he sat out the year, and I think Duquesne won again. But his friends in 1900 started this, wanted to professionalize the Homestead Club that just had amateur teams in 98-99. So they got Temple to come on board and basically give him the same deal that he had given Duquesne, which was, look, your club won't lose any money, you won't make any money, I'm going to run the whole thing, you know, make or break. So they took the deal, and he did it to basically get, you know, his revenge on his former buddies at Duquesne. And so, of course, he had deeper pockets. He started cherry picking some of the Duquesne players, big names like Dave Fultz, John Gammons. And so that intensified the rivalry further. At first, Duquesne didn't even want to play them. Refused to play them, told them to go get a reputation, so on and so on. But eventually they even got Washington and Jefferson to agree not to play Homestead. But then in the end, they capitulated, you know, for financial reasons, most likely to get a big crowd out, and they played. But Homestead took care of business and won the championship in 1900. So that was the year before Philadelphia and Blondie Wallace decided to expand pro football to the eastern part of the state, and then it took it to the next level.
Okay. Now, that championship game that you talked about, there was an award for winning that championship, and you have a kind of an interesting story that you brought into modern times of, I believe, with that trophy. Would you like to share that story with us?
Sure. So there was a newspaper then called the Pittsburgh Commercial Gazette, and to encourage the many, you know, the few teams around the area to compete against each other, particularly, you know, Duquesne and Homestead, to get them to play, the paper sponsored the creation, the development, the production of this trophy, a beautiful trophy as it was pictured, at least sketched in the newspaper at the time. It was a 11 cup shaped like a football with two handles on, you know, on the sides and a lid on the top. And it had beautiful engravings of a football scene on one side, goalposts, and so on. So pretty special thing, and Homestead won that. And so that was 1900. And then a similar trophy was offered by another group the following year, a much bigger sterling silver cup in 1901 for the championship that Homestead won again. And long story short, when I went on my journey's discovery and found out that the Carnegie Library of Homestead that stands now is the same building that was called Homestead Library and Athletic Club then, which I didn't know until 2012. I went there and discovered those trophies still in their storage closet, and they didn't even know what they had there. And I had only recognized them from the sketches and in the newspapers back then, and immediately called the Pro Football Hall of Fame in Canton, and they asked if they could display them. So that's where they went, and are still there in the very first exhibit in the rotunda sits the 1901 trophy, and the 1900 trophy goes around the country on their traveling exhibit called Gridiron Glory. So that was a very special find and a very exciting moment in my life.
Yeah, no, so it was just sitting there collecting dust, these two trophies, which are probably the equivalent to the Lombardi trophy that we know of today, because this was the championship of pro football as we knew it at that time. And these things were put away for, 100 years, probably?
112, 111 years when I found them. And so the many people call them the Holy Grail of pro football. The Hall of Fame says they're the first known world championship pro football trophy. So that's really
that is really cool. And you helped refine them and bring them back into the light, so people could enjoy looking at them. So that's wonderful. That's great thing. Now, you have a picture of one of the trophies in your book, and I'm assuming it's it's an antiquated looking picture. So I'm assuming it's maybe the newspaper description that you were talking about. And that's is that one of the photos maybe that helped you recognize the trophies?
Right, exactly. So I sort of teased the readers early, in the sections describing the games at the time, and show the newspaper image from both years. And then, at the end, reveal that, that we found them and show them in their, real glory, their shiny, surprises, out of the bag for you.
Well, I'd say you have a lot of revelations at the end of the book. It's I'm not going to spoil them for the people, because folks, you got to get this book. It's really a really well done book. And if you love sports history, you'll love this. If you love football history, you'll really love this book. And because it's basically the missing origin story of pro football. And Greg does a great job of displaying it and telling the story. And, it's an excellent book. I highly recommend it. Now, Greg, sort of the central theme of this book is because your great grandfather played on some of these teams, and he played for Homestead too, didn't he?
Right. He came on onto the pro scene a few years after the very first one, the Heffelfinger group. Best I can tell, he started playing in 1897 in a local team in the Turtle Creek area, a team called the Turtle Creek Indians, also known as the Marquette Athletic Club. A little funny story: when people asked him if he went to college, where he played, and he said he played at Marquette, and people didn't know that it was, it wasn't the school, it was just a little club in Wilmerding. But after he went from there to a team in Swissvale in 98, and I think in 99 he ended up playing for a really strong amateur athletic club called the James F. Lallis Athletic Club. And Lallis had played against Heffelfinger in that first game. So, it was just one degree of separation really between Heffelfinger and my great-grandfather was Jim Lallis. And he had been a policeman in the Pittsburgh area and a good, great amateur player and then started his own club that was the best amateur club in the area for a few years. And as things went, the amateur teams played the pro teams, and they played Homestead in 1900. And the Homestead players and teams saw how well Shiring played. And when they put the team together in 1901, they invited him to come and join the team initially as a backup to the Princeton All-American Pete Overfield, who played center. But they gave my great-grandfather a lot of playing time, and in games that weren't as competitive. And I think he played in pretty much every game except the two against the Lallis Club, because there was some resentment there that he had left their team and things might have gotten ugly. So, but at the end of the season in 1901, Overfield wasn't able to play in the second Philadelphia game. And after Homestead had won the first one, and then Philadelphia came and challenged them to a rematch in Pittsburgh this time, and Shiring played that whole game, and they won again at the very end.
But so it was that second game that after Philadelphia wanted to play that second game, after they lost that game, wasn't that the one they were saying, "Hey, that was just an exhibition; it doesn't mean anything." something like that, because they were
That might have been the 1902 season that got awfully complicated at the end with some, they'd each won one game and then they wanted to, play a third. But in 1901, Homestead beat them handily in Philadelphia, 18-0. But Philadelphia claimed that all the scores were flukes and they wanted another chance. And Homestead had a game on Thanksgiving against W&J, which they weren't able to play the previous year, as I mentioned, because Duquesne sort of blocked that. And so the only way that Homestead could play was if they played 2 days after Thanksgiving, that W&J game. And they said, well, we're not afraid to play anybody. Well, let's see what happens in the W&J game. And they came out of it pretty unscathed injury wise. And they said, come on over. We'll whoop you again. And they played 2 days later. And so they were tired. The game didn't start well for them and they were behind at halftime, but they rallied to tie the game at the very end with 5-5, when touchdowns were worth five. And it all came down to the dramatic extra point, and which they made once, and was they were made to kick again because the referee claimed the holder had put his finger under the ball to give it balance in the snow or whatever, but he made it both times, and they were credited with the world championship.
That's a fascinating stuff there, and I appreciate you sharing these stories and the hard research you did on these things, because this is great stuff. Now, Greg, why don't you tell us once again what the name of your book is and where folks can get a copy of it?
Mm-hmm. So, Gridiron Legacy, Pro Football's Missing Origin Story, and you can get signed copies from me at gridironlegacy.com, which you won't be able to get on Amazon later in the year. So, encourage you to go there.
Yeah, and something that's kind of special about this book, it was special prior to December, but the foreword of the book is by the late Franco Harris. And I know you had a relationship with Franco, and I don't know if you wanted to say anything about that or.
Oh, sure. That's nice. Can't say enough about what a warm and thoughtful person Franco was, and how much I enjoyed, the little time that we spent together. Not that I was in his inner circle or anything, but we first reconnected as adults after meeting him a couple times when I was a kid. But at the Heinz History Center, we were both on their advisory board together starting in 2012. And He was the head of that board, which they called the Champions Committee. And in my first meeting there, you know, I shared with the group my story that I was working on. And Franco was a passionate, you know, sports historian, football historian. And he really, I could tell he was really focused on, you know, when I was talking about it. And he approached me later and you know, to give me some encouragement, asked me some questions, and he asked me what he could do to help, you know, which was really special. And I said, well, you know, I have a lot of work ahead of me, but it'd be great if you'd do the foreword for me at some point when I'm ready. And he said, absolutely, he would. Just, you know, he said something meaningful at the time, which was, don't worry about how long it takes. He said, you know, you have something really special. It's an evergreen project, and it's not going anywhere, and it'll be ready when it's supposed to be ready. So just do a good job with it, basically. And that was meaningful and gave me some peace, as it took me about, you know, 10 more years to finish the project. And when I circled back with him, he was joked with me and pretended that he forgot that he promised to do the foreword, but that was Franco. And he said he was glad to do it. And we had a lot of fun conversations as we worked through it together, mostly on the phone, and talked, you know, shared a lot of other stories as well.
Yeah, he was, you know, I grown up in Western Pennsylvania myself. He was a childhood hero of mine, you know, many of those Steelers were. And he is one of the ones that I never had the opportunity to meet in person other than watching a game and going to the stadium, watching a game down at Three Rivers or in Cleveland or Buffalo, which are nearby to me too. And, you know, I have a dirty little secret that I got to share. I was hoping, you know, the PFRA convention is in Pittsburgh this summer, the end of July. And folks, if you're looking for details on that, you can send me an email, pigskindispatch@gmail.com. I'll get you in touch with the PFRA and their website in George Bazika and get you so you can get involved with that. But I was hoping that, you know, you're going to be coming. I'm not sure if you are or not. I know you were at the last convention. And I was hoping by some miracle that we would have, you know, Franco would be able to make an appearance when we have some guests there, usually on Saturdays. And unfortunately, this whole tragedy of losing him before that happened, and, you know, kind of a shock to the world, especially a couple days before he was going to be honored with having his number retired at the stadium.
Right. So. The timing was really unfortunate.
You know, the man is you know, like I said, I never met him, but just hearing interviews, hearing stories like you telling there, you know, a gentle giant and good humored, but unrecognizable with his violent running style on the football field, you know, violent, yeah, but graceful. And, you know, his cutbacks and everything, just amazing man. And I think he'll be remembered for a long time. That's for sure.
I'll give you one story that I haven't shared, at least on a podcast or radio interview before, about a conversation we had since we're doing a little longer form talk. When he asked me to send him, you know, the draft of the book, obviously it wasn't printed yet because I didn't have all the quotes and everything and the foreword done, but I sent him a soft copy to read over a weekend. And so he could get a feel for it and what to write. And he said, call me on Monday and we'll talk about it. So I called him and he said, well, I couldn't read the whole thing, but I read the beginning and the introduction you wrote. And he said, wow, he said, you're a really good writer. And I said, wow, that thanks. That means a lot to me. And he said, there was one line in particular that got me, you know, that got my attention. And I said, I bet I know what it was. And he said, well, what do you think? And it was, I told him how one night, you know, I struggled with what to write in my introduction because it was different than the rest of the story. It was a more personal kind of reflection on why I was, what the book was about. And I woke up in the middle of the night and I just went to the kitchen. I had the vision. I wrote it all in a half hour. In the first, it started out with something to the effect that as athletes, we live for moments when we become more than we thought we could be. And it could be in an instant, just a move or a play that we make that nobody really understands or saw, or it could be something that lasts forever, that's immortalized, you know, in front of millions of people. And he said, yeah, that was it. He said, I really, you know, connected with that. And I said, well, of course you had the Immaculate Reception, you know, that lives forever. And he said, no, that wasn't it. He said, it was the first part. He said, it was the private, you know, the internal joy of a moment that when you do something special. He said, I laid in bed thinking of this move that I always wanted to do. And in one game against the Cowboys, I did it. And I said, was it in a Super Bowl? And he said, no. He said, it was just a regular season game. And there was this linebacker they had named Lewis. And I said, yeah, D.D. Lewis. He said, yeah, you got it. He said, I put this move on him and twisted him all up and faked it. And I scored. And it was just like I had imagined. And it felt so good. And he said, that's just like why we love sports. And that's what I liked about what you wrote. That was really, and I'm like, wow, that was really cool. You know, to have that special connection, you know, with some my thoughts about what I was writing, why I wrote it. And he said, even better, years later, I saw D.D. Lewis speak somewhere, and he started telling this story about this move that Franco put on him, and said, he ended up with his hand inside of his face mask. So, and he said, D.D. got it, you know, somebody else appreciated the move, but that was one of my favorite Franco.
Yeah. That's a great story, especially you have a legendary Hall of Fame running back thinking about something that you wrote as he's going to bed, you know, so many years after he's done playing. That's pretty special. That's quite a testament to your writing. So great job. And folks, if you haven't bought Greg's book yet, you know, let's stop procrastinating, get on to gridironlegacy.com. And I'm telling you, you want to have a copy, and especially an autographed copy. It's a really a great book and filled with many of the things that we've talked about here today, but there's so much more, and there's so many other teams that are involved in, you know, this great era of football before the NFL of professional football. And Greg goes through, you know, step-by-step how pro football was built almost right up to the time of the NFL coming in 1920. So Greg, we really appreciate you coming on here, sharing some of these great stories and, you know, intimate conversations with the legend Franco Harris. And we appreciate you, sir, for sharing your great-grandfather's story and that of the Homestead Library and Athletic Club.
Well, thanks, Darren. It's great to focus on the Pittsburgh teams a little more than usual. The Maslin and Canton rivalry gets most of the attention from that period. And But the Pittsburgh era, it was special and had a lot of interesting, you know, little vignettes as well. So good. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to share that.
Peeking up at the clock, the time's running down. We're going to go into victory formation, take a knee, and let this baby run out. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back tomorrow for the next podcast.
We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. A special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network. Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour. How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.